All right, at this time, it gives me pleasure to introduce Caitlin Seed.
Hi, my name is Caitlin, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is October 15th, 2009, so I have just a little over 12 years of sobriety. It's crazy, no matter how many times I do this, get up and speak, it's just super nervous every single time. And I don't know what it is about this time, especially this, like, it's not an especially big meeting, but yeah, I didn't listen to anything any of the birthday people said, because I was just thinking about myself, to be quite honest. Happy birthday to all of you. But yeah, it's, you know, even 12 years down the road, that's still, you know, I'm always thinking about myself and what other people are going to think of me. And honestly, that was the number one thing that has made me sick in my life. And I didn't really know that that's what it was that was making me so sick and so nervous, and so why it was so hard for me to like integrate into the stream of life was that I was just constantly thinking about myself. And I think that was probably like the biggest relief, one of the biggest reliefs I found when I came into AA, was that like selfishness, self-centeredness is the root of our problems. And I was like, whoa, like really? I mean, I thought like my ex-husband was the root of my problems. I thought it was that guy that was a jerk to me at the gas station. I thought it was that hippie that stole my money in San Francisco and he promised he would give me a bunch of acid and he just disappeared into an apartment complex and never came back. Like, I just thought there were all these different things. It was my boss. It was my sister. It was my parents. It was my teacher. It was, you know, the public school system. All these things were my problem. And then when I found out that it was just like a manifestation of the obsession of self, I think that was probably one of the reasons why I just went with AA. Like, my first meeting was on October 10th of 2009, and my sobriety date's on the 15th. I don't really count that 5 days. Like, I don't really count it as a relapse because I wasn't 100%. I'd never really committed to the program anyways. But I've more or less been sober since my first meeting, except for I just smoked a little bit of weed between the two, and just a recommendation, if you're gonna relapse, just don't do it on weed. It's not the same ever again. The paranoia is out of control, and I just knew at that time, I was like, wow, this is never gonna be fun again. I can't even smoke weed anymore. So I'll back up just a little bit. I grew up in Huntington Beach, which is in Orange County. If you're not familiar with it, I have an older sister. Things were going pretty well in my life until I was about four. I would say I had a solid 4 years of good, you know, healthy life under my belt. And, you know, at the time I was living in Anaheim Hills with my mom and my dad and my sister, and, you know, we had a cute little place, and everything in my mind was perfect. Like, I had the perfect life. I remember specifically, like, sitting in my car seat thinking, like, my life is perfect. You know, I've seen those other kids, like, on Cops or, like, you know, TV, whatever. Like, my life isn't like theirs. Like, I'm really happy. Like, I had a genuine sense of gratitude for my family. I've always been very family-oriented. And it wasn't shortly after that that I found out my parents were getting a divorce. My dad had had, you know, a girl on the side, and he decided that he wanted, you know, her to be the main thing. So my parents split up. My dad moved out. And it was just this really rapid succession of changes in my life. And I was like, you know, I was probably five at that time. And my mom, who was like my whole world, she was just, I followed her around like a little duckling until I was way too old to be doing that. She looked at me one day and said, Katie, you got to make some friends, like, because you're just bugging me. And I was like, okay, like, I thought, you know, I thought we were friends, you know, I'm like 13. But so anyways, you know, after my dad left, my mom ended up trying to kill herself. And I don't remember exactly who came and was with us during that time. I think it was one of my grandparents came down to watch us. But I have like this really like distinct, clear memories of my life as a kid, but I don't have any memory of what happened the weekend that my mom tried to kill herself. And luckily she didn't succeed. She tried again and she also didn't succeed, thank God. But it was just like this massive change in my life. Like I had this perfect life. We had a cool little dog. I was set up. I had some lizards. It was awesome. I was selling them on the side for money and like life was good. I had my money to buy pogs and snacks and my parents and everything was cool. And then all of a sudden it wasn't, you know? And, the woman my dad married was not a kind woman. He married into a family that was just completely different than the one I had been used to. He had married this like really pretty Hispanic lady that had a huge extended family. And I always had like a really small, like, you know, nuclear family. And it was like, you know, just parties every single weekend and drinking and like jokes that I wasn't used to. And, you know, calling me all types of names in Spanish that I didn't understand. And they would tell me like, oh, it just means like, you know, dork or whatever. And then I'd go to school and start like dropping these bombs on kids, like calling them putas and stuff. And like, I'm like, it means dork. And like, no, like that's not what they were calling me. So yeah, like it was a crazy time in my life and I don't remember a ton of it because I think it was a lot to take in. We ended up, that was when we made the move to Huntington Beach. Another bomb that got dropped at that time in my life was my mom was like, listen, I'm seeing someone and it's a woman and we're gonna go move in with her. And I was like, okay, that's cool. Like, I didn't really have any opinions on that when I was 5 years old, but it, once again, it was just another thing that, you know, made me feel different than the kids that I was going to school with. And it was a different time, you know, it was like, what, 1993 or something? Like, the progress that we see now, that was not the case then. And like, it was just still a don't ask, don't tell type thing. And that was just another thing that I had to learn, how to hide. And I never felt comfortable bringing friends back to my house. It wasn't just because of the nature of their relationship, but my mom's partner became pretty obvious pretty soon that she never wanted kids. Like, she wanted to be with my mom, and it just so happened my mom had kids. And so, you know, it became this scenario where, like, during the week, we lived at my mom's partner's house in Huntington Beach, and we just kind of had to pretend like we weren't there because, you know, everything we did, if we chewed our food wrong, it was an issue. If we, you know, touched a surface, you know, shortly after we had coughed, it was an issue. If I opened a, you know, appliance incorrectly, it was an issue. So I was just like always on eggshells. And then I would go to my dad's house at the week, during the weekend where, his wife was, you know, verbally and emotionally abusive to us, and her extended family were abusive towards my sister and I in other ways. And, you know, my dad always told us, like, you know, this is your family here on the weekend, and any issues you have with this family, it stays here. You don't take it home and tell it to your mom. We'll solve it here. Like, you don't need to go spreading this around. And I don't think he knew the nature of what was going on at the time. I think he was just kind of ignorant of what was going on. I'd like to think that had he actually known, you know, we wouldn't have had conversations in that same way and that he would have been there for us. But that's not the way it happened, you know? And, so, you know, this like life just kept going on where, you know, I'd gone from like this loving, happy, open home into like, you know, these two divided homes, neither of which I felt, my sister and I both, we didn't feel welcome in and we didn't feel safe in, and there really wasn't any safe place to go. You know, the police had already, you know, had to pull my sister and I out of school before to question us on different stuff. And I just kind of knew, I didn't have to be told too many times just to keep my mouth shut about stuff. Like, everything was going to be easier as long as I just kept my mouth shut. And, you know, nothing was being done to draw blood. You know, I wasn't, you know, trying to go to school with broken limbs or anything. So in my head, I didn't know any different. Like, just be quiet. It could be worse. It's not like the kids on Cops that you see getting taken away from their parents. Like, it's fine. Like, terrible that my only frame of reference was Cops, but, like, you know, who knows? It got me through that time, you know? And, you know, I never really, I didn't know that the way I perceived things was different than anybody else. I didn't know that most people didn't, like, you know, worry themselves to the point of physical sickness over, you know, simple things throughout the day. I didn't know that it was normal to be able to talk openly about what happens at your home, or I didn't know any of that. And I didn't know that I didn't know. I was just sort of picking it up as I went, and my sister and I were both in this survival mode and trying to figure out how to navigate the hand we were dealt. And honestly, there was a ton of happiness during that time. Like, I had step siblings that I just adored, and I enjoyed the weekend parties. And, you know, there are some family members that I got really, you know, really attached to. And there was a lot of goodness and fun and happiness and laughter. And I didn't know that those kinds of things could coincide with, like, you know, trauma and abuse. And so it was, you know, a lot for a little kid to take in. And, you know, like I said, I was super attached to my mom, and, I didn't really make any other friends. I didn't have any desire to. My sister was always, like, the beautiful, popular, outgoing one. She had these dimples and big blue eyes and black hair, and she was just so funny and dressed so well. And I was, like, always just kind of the weird one. I didn't mind it. I thought I was pretty cool. I just loved to skateboard, and I wore, you know, long corduroy shorts and chain wallets, and that's just who I was. I wanted to be like the boys on Sandlot. That was, you know, my goal. And, you know, I also didn't really have any friends. I also didn't really care. I had my mom, and then one day she just sat me down and she said, "Caitlin, you're bugging the hell out of me. You need to go make some friends." And I was like, okay, like, fine, if you're going to be a dick like that, I'll go make some friends. Like, let's see what I can do, you know? And, you know, that little budding alcoholic mind in me, like, I don't know. It was like I already had this, like, I was just not repulsed, but I wouldn't navigate towards healthy people. That just wasn't who I was. If I was, like, forced to make friends, for one, I'm terrified of anybody. I'm afraid that I don't measure up to them, but I don't even know that at the time. I just immediately gravitate towards the kids on the periphery. You know, the kids who, like, they have that look in their eyes, like, you know, they have secrets too. And, you know, the kids that are already, like, cutting themselves and smoking weed and drinking, and all the girls, you know, we were in middle school, they all had older boyfriends, like, grossly older. And I don't know, it just seemed like a place of safety in that group. And, you know, in retrospect, I do thank God that I at least found them, because it was at least somebody. You know, we got each other into trouble, and we introduced each other to horrible things, but we were there for each other, and we were all that we had, you know, at least at that time. And so I had always done well in school. I had always thought that, like, I don't know, I thought I was going to grow up and make something of myself. You know, I had a grandma that I was really attached to. And she would always, you know, point at me and say, "That one, she's going to be something one day." And that meant a lot to me. I didn't have a lot of that in my life. And, you know, she was just this beautiful Holocaust survivor. She'd been in a concentration camp. She was British and had this British accent and always had her hair done. And just hearing that that's what she thought about me, it just it meant a lot to me. And I thought, I must be made of something valuable. I don't know what it is, but it must be something. And so when I first started hanging out with these kids, I was like, okay, I'm going to hang out with them. But like my shtick is I'm going to be the good one. Like, I'm not going to do drugs. I'm not going to drink. You know, my dad was a recovering alcoholic. I have a lot of alcoholics in my family. But my dad, I never actually saw him drink. He got sober when my mom was pregnant with me. But I always heard stories about what my dad was like. And I was just like, I don't want to be like him. And I don't want to be like his sister, who was like my example growing up of an alcoholic. You know, she was gross. She was always drunk. She smelled bad. Sometimes she'd do funny stuff. And that was always interesting at holidays. But like, you never knew what you were going to get from her. And it was just, yeah, she was good for a few laughs. But even at the age of like 7, 8, 9, like, no, we don't respect Auntie Lisa. That's just, we all know, like, we tolerate her, but we don't actually respect her. And she's an example of what we don't want to be. And my mom used to always tell me, don't drink, Katie, like, it's bad for you. Like, you have alcoholism on both sides of your families. Your dad was a monster when he would drink. Just if that was just something she always tried to instill in me. And so when I was hanging out with these kids, you know, I thought for a long time that I could just hang out with them and get the value of that friendship and that camaraderie and not do what they did, you know. But, you know, you go to a barbershop, you're going to get a haircut and whatever. Like, I eventually, the first thing I ever did was smoke weed. And I was 14. I didn't really, like, you know, stick out the good girl routine for very long. But I swore that I was never going to drink because I wasn't going to be like my dad. You know, I wasn't going to be like my dad. I wasn't going to be like my aunt. But from the moment I smoked weed, I was doing it every single day. Like, I didn't know that I had something inside of me that was that powerful. I didn't know that it could even be possible to be, like, addicted to weed. Like, that sounds like the lamest thing possible. But I also didn't know that there was an alternative to the way I was feeling all the time. Like, the constant worrying, the wondering, like, just the constant state of fear that I was in. I didn't even know that I was in a constant state of fear until I had felt a way of living that was opposite to that. And sooner or later, like, it didn't take long for me to give in to alcohol. And I remember, like, it was probably a year later, a couple months, I don't know. But I remember my first drink, and it was like, you know, one of those under the sink mixtures, like, where you just take a little bit of every bottle in your parents' cabinet so that they don't notice that too much is gone from any one bottle. And I took a drink of that, and I just felt it, like, go down my throat, and then it just hit my stomach and, like, sizzled in there. And I felt, like, all of the worries, like, from my head to my toes just melt down and just drip out of my fingertips. And it was like, thank God that's over. Like, this is what's in the bottle? This is amazing. Like, nobody told me that this is what's in the bottle. Like, I thought it was just falling down. I thought it was bad teeth, ratty hair, overweight. Like, you didn't tell me that, like, the solution to all my problems was in this bottle. And at that moment, I resolved to, I was like, if I can just take measured quantities of alcohol all day long, not too much to get drunk, just enough to keep my problems away, like, I can do anything. I can take on anything in this world. I can be that person that I always thought I was. I can do this. And that's actually terrifying to think that was my knee-jerk reaction. But like I said, I didn't know just how tightly I had been wound until something came by and uncoiled me. And from that moment on, I just couldn't imagine my life without a substance in it. Like, I was, you know, I started acting out shortly after that, you know, when I was like 14, 15, my mom didn't know what to do with me. So she just sent me to a psychiatrist, and he, you know, met with me for 20 minutes, had me fill out a questionnaire that I didn't give a shit about. I just checked a bunch of boxes and was like, whatever, I'm crazy. Like, what do you want? And he was like, according to this questionnaire, like, you are schizophrenic, you know, bipolar, insomnia, ADHD. And I was like, whatever, I don't care. And he's like, I'm going to write you a bunch of prescriptions. And I was like, cool. And so I went home, like, you know, went to the pharmacist, picked up all my prescriptions that my mom said I had to take because I was so difficult. And I was like, whatever, I'm not going to take these. And then I looked at one of them, and it was, like, the generic, you know, because that's cheaper. But it didn't say the brand name. It just said what it actually was, and it said amphetamine salts. And I was like, I've heard about that. That sounds like methamphetamine. And I just got a lot of it for, you know, a very small amount of money. And so when I first started taking, you know, it was Adderall. It was a massive amount of Adderall. And I was like, what the heck else did my doctor just hook me up with? And I started going through all the different pills, and I realized that some had more favorable results than other ones. And I was like, cool. Like, for one, I just, like, I have this legal, like, my mom's gonna drive me to this doctor every week for him to write me, like, prescriptions for this stuff. And then I also got, like, my first part-time job by selling all the extra ones to all my, you know, all my friends, all my other 13, 14-year-old friends. And that just became a way of life for me. And I found out that, you know, if I take the Adderall while I'm drinking, I don't black out and I don't get sloppy. I don't get messy. Like, I am that person. Like, I'm the person, like, in my head, the person of my dreams. It is me. Like, amphetamines plus alcohol, it's absolutely perfect. But, you know, I was young and I was impulsive and I would take them and sell them faster than I could get them refilled. And I would, of course, always run out. And then I was just in this place where, like, my daily mood and my physical health, everything was contingent upon, like, this constant cocktail of alcohol, drugs, legal and illegal, in my system. And, like, at a very young age, I had to learn to plan my life around that. And I didn't get in trouble very much. Part of it was I just kind of looked innocent when I was like 14, 15. I looked much younger than I was. I could speak well. I didn't mouth off to authority figures. And I just knew how to, like, fly under the radar. And, you know, while all my friends were, they would get expelled for just looking at somebody wrong, like, I could come to school just completely trashed. And, you know, the administrators would pull me aside and ask what was going on. And I would just, like, you know, very politely say some story. Like, it was just a bad day. I won't do it again. I won't do it again. Or, you know, a little bit of a sob story, not too much that you call DCFS on my parents and get them involved. But, like, I was just very, very manipulative, and I was willing to do that because I didn't know how else to, like, keep up with my medicine, you know, with my drinking. It was just the most important thing in life to me. And, you know, shortly after high school, I feel like I just met, like, I just chose the first person I saw and chose to marry them. I decided that Huntington Beach was getting too hot and I was getting into too much trouble, and the drinking needed to stop. It needed to slow down. So I was going to do my first geographic and move up to Humboldt County because I was like, you know, it's just weed. I've never gotten into a fight on weed. Like, that doesn't happen. Like, I need to just go relax. I'll enroll in college up there. I'll just smoke a bunch of moderately priced weed and save some money, and it'll be fine. And, you know, that was the first time really being out from underneath anybody's supervision. And we found a liquor store in the corner, of course, that sold to us without an ID. And that was when I first really started having my recurrent blackouts. And again, it happened a few times before, but always it would be something kind of cheeky, like, oh, what happened last night? And they're like, oh, you locked yourself in the bathroom and then you barked, but then we were laughing and you just stayed in there and slept until morning. And then, you know, we just had to go to the bathroom outside. Ha ha ha. Like, kind of funny stuff. No one's too mad at you when that happens. But like, I'd started waking up and I would just wake up in this stupor and be like covered in bruises and the house was trashed. And I'd be like, what happened? And my husband at the time was like, you happened. And I'm like, what? And he's like, yeah, like you spit a mouthful of food at me and then you just started swinging and you said you hate me. And I was like, no, like you're just trying to make me look bad because you don't have a job. So you're just making up things that I do when I drink. Like, and that's ridiculous. And then slowly, like, I started coming to in the middle of these, like, blackout episodes. And, like, I was this monster that was doing these horrible things. And, like, you know, occasionally he would hit me back. But it was, like, fully deserved. Like, I had pushed him far to his limit. Oh, and by the way, I'm, like, heavily overweight at this point. I probably, like, outweighed my husband by about 60 pounds and was like 6 inches taller than him at the time. Like, I tried to pull that battered wife syndrome card, but it was, that one was definitely my fault. Like, I definitely had the few slaps that I took. I had them coming. But I was like, who is this person? And that was the first time I started trying to like control and manage my drinking. I was like, okay, tequila doesn't work for me. Like, tequila makes me hit people. And then next it was, okay, vodka. Vodka makes me pee my pants. And then I was like, just beer. Okay, we'll just do beer. And then, of course, you know, it just gets tedious drinking, you know, beer after beer. And so then that was when, like, Steel Reserves were, like, really a thing. And, you know, you can get, like, truly wasted off of $2 at that time, and that was exactly what I was looking for. But then the fighting and the peeing and the trashing the house and all those things started happening, even with the Steel Reserve. And I was like, wow, like, do I have a problem with alcohol? And that thought was just quickly supplanted with, no, you have a problem with all these other people. You've got a problem, like, your husband won't get a job. The city of Eureka sucks and everyone's out to get you because they're jealous that you're from Orange County and not their crappy town. And, like, just, you know, all these things that we make up to, like, you know, because we have, like, for me, I have to continually build myself up and be on this pedestal above other people just to even feel like I deserve to, like, make eye contact with others. And, you know, I wasn't ready to admit that I was an alcoholic. Needless to say, we lost that apartment in Eureka. We moved back in with his parents, my ex-husband's parents in Garden Grove. And, like, they were, like, true blue alcoholics. And they were also animal hoarders. It was the oddest scenario. Just, like, blackout, drunk, falling all over the place with hairless cats, like, mewing about. And it was just so, if you, like, passed out and were still enough, like, a dog would think you needed to be, like, tagged, and then one dog would go by and pee on you, and then all the others would go by and pee on you. And it was like, I was like, what the hell is this place? Like, how did this happen? Like, my grandmother said I was going to be something great. Like, how is these dogs are peeing on me? Like, and I think, like, one of my moments of clarity came in that house was when my father-in-law was like, you are out of your damn mind and you need to get out of the house. And I was like, I need to get out of this house? Like, this house with, like, I think we did a head count and there were, like, 50 or 60 animals in this two-bedroom house. It was disgusting. It was, like, set to be condemned. And I was like, I'm the one that's getting kicked out, you know? And, like, we would always do this cute thing where, like, we'd get drunk, I'd start a fight with somebody, it'd be super dramatic, I'd be like, I'm gonna leave. And they'd be like, no, Caitlin, don't leave, just stay, we're family. And then I'd be like, okay. And then finally, you know, I started our game one day and, like, you know, got drunk, picked a fight, and I was like, I'm going to leave. And they were like, go, just get out of our lives. And I was like, guys, come on. Like, this is what we do. We're family, right? And they were like, no, you need to go. Like, you need to go as soon as possible. And that was more or less the dissolution of that marriage. And I don't recall even missing him. I think if anything, I felt like I'd broken up with myself, and it was just my pride that was hurt. And, you know, it was just like more and more and more of that, like similar relationships with different people. And the longer that I was, you know, staying out there, doing things on my own, the higher the stakes got, you know. And then, like, people started dying, and I'm only 20 at this time, and it's horrible. I can't keep a job. I think it's because of all the, you know, long-standing mental illness that I was diagnosed with when I was young. It couldn't be the alcohol, you know. And I was just completely, completely lost. It wasn't like there was some time of sanity I could revert to in my life to be like, okay, like, it, you know, at this time that was working. There was none of that. Like, for as long as I could remember, I couldn't even get out of bed without something. Like, my routine was before bed at night to, like, put the amphetamines on top of my alarm clock. Then it would go off in the morning. I'd hit snooze, take the amphetamines, and then by the time the alarm went off again, they were working. And that was the only way I knew how to get out of bed and get the day started and get up to have another drink. I didn't have anything. And I was just like, if this is what life is, I'm not interested. Like, I don't want to live. I don't bring anything to anybody. And I started thinking about suicide and started making plans and, you know, writing the letters. And, you know, it wasn't just like a dramatic thing at this point. Like, I was really getting ready to just be done and wash my hands of this life, you know. And I had a friend that brought me into that, like, you know, she had first introduced me to a lot of hard drugs, and I had heard that she was going to meetings and that she was actually sober. And I just, like, sat there one day, and it was, you know, just like the hangover to end all hangovers. And through my blaring headache, I made two phone calls. One, I called her and she didn't answer. I wanted to see if she would take me to a meeting, but I left a message. And then I called another friend to ask if he could bring me some booze. And neither of them answered, and I left a message for both of them and asked them to call me back. And I just decided whoever calls back first is that's what I'm gonna do with the rest of my life. Like, I didn't really know it was like that long standing, but, you know, the dude never called me back, but she called me back in about 20 minutes, and she took me to my first meeting, and it was a room like this. And I've never heard the speaker since. I just heard him that one time. So, like, I don't think he was a circuit speaker or anything like that, but he just told my story of hopelessness and, you know, all the pain and all the secrets and all the things I thought I could never tell anybody. And he just told it. And I, like, my mind was absolutely blown. And from there, I was hooked. Like, I don't have that story of not knowing whether or not I wanted to be an AA or of fighting the program and the principals and sitting in the back of the room and not participating. Like, I felt like a lifeline was thrown to me that day. And I suddenly had the answer to all of my problems. And it was just like selfishness, self-centeredness, not participating in life, because I don't participate in anybody's life but myself. All my anxieties have been solved by service to other people. I'm still a person. I still have fears, but everything I do, it's just, I don't know why I had the gift of just getting it at the time, like just understanding the third step, just give it up. Like, it just sat with me, and it was a seed that was planted in my heart. And, you know, I just did the 12 steps. I didn't know it was an option to not do the 12 steps. And I just made friends. It was the first real friends I had ever made in my life. And I was so far in my sobriety, I haven't found anything that's worth it to compromise the relationships and the serenity and the peace of mind that I've gotten from this program. And like, I have a husband now, a new one. And we've been married for almost 8 years, and we have two beautiful little girls. And, you know, we're both doing our best to just give them all the things that we didn't get enough of, and, you know, give them less of all the things that we wished we'd never gotten, you know? And I owe it all to Alcoholics Anonymous. I just couldn't be the kind of person and the mom that I am today if it weren't for AA. Like, no matter where I go, there's a room full of people that just know me. I don't have to tell them, like, you all just know me. And I'm so grateful for it, and I'm just so grateful for the 12 steps, and I'm grateful for the 12 traditions, too. The last 4 years have been a really, really divisive time, and there's so many reasons to, like, hate your neighbor, you know, and I'm just so grateful for the traditions in AA that, like, you know, that we have no opinion on outside issues, because there's been so much fear and just unprecedented levels of division in people. But I know that when I walk into a meeting, like, regardless of what we think out there, like, we're all in this boat trying to, you know, save our necks. And, like, if we can't keep this boat afloat, like, we're all gonna die. And I just really, really appreciate that. And I'm grateful for you giving me the opportunity to speak tonight. And thank you for my sobriety. Like, I get to be the person I used to pretend that I was. So thank you very much.